You're listening to WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to spend the first segment of our show talking about sod and athletic fields. And our guest authored the book, The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadow of Sport's Greatest Fields. It's about famed groundskeeper George Toma, who, among other things, worked in the on the first 57 Super Bowl fields. Author Craig Handel is with us. He's a journalist. He's written six other collaborative books. His latest books to be published in the next year include one on entrepreneurism and another on a young man born at 23 and a half weeks and how he's overcome many problems to live a productive life. But first, with him, we're talking about the sod father, and I hope you'll join in. Give us questions you have about being a groundskeeper. Maybe you've done a little of that yourself. Or let us know how you think the field affects athletes. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Greg Handel, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Larry, I really appreciate it. Here you're a big baseball fan as well as being a big gardener.
Well, I am, and I've watched a lot of hockey in my day here at the University of Wisconsin. I'm sure I know I've watched over 100 in-person hockey matches with the UW
Larry,
Badgers.
Larry, I got to ask you, because I worked on another book with a guy by the name of Greg Poss, who played for the University of Wisconsin. He ended up then becoming a hockey coach down here with the Florida Everblades. He also worked with a guy by the name of Raj Najawan, who is big into developing your mind. I don't know if you've ever heard of these guys.
I have, right off the top of my head, I can't think of the fact that I have, but I tell you what, George Toma, who you collaborated with on this book, is a fascinating guy. How did you come to work with him?
Well, it's a great question, Larry. He did a lot of work with the Minnesota Twins, and so before spring training started, he would come down to Fort Myers, Florida, which is where I used to live. And for many years, he worked on the fields. And so after a ball game, I went down to the field and I talked to George, and he you know, talked to me like he knew me forever, gave me one of his cards, and I always kept him in mind. And there was this magazine in Florida that I wrote about, it's called Florida Country Magazine, and I thought George would be the perfect guy to write about, because not only did he work with all these Super Bowl fields, but he worked in Tallahassee, he worked in West Palm Beach, he worked in, you know, down in Sarasota and Fort Myers. And so I called him, Larry, and said, George, would you be interested in doing a book? And he said, yes. And he says, but we're going to start at the very beginning. And then while we were having this conversation for the article, he started telling me about all his challenges with the Super Bowls over the years. And so I said, okay, maybe we got something here. And I talked to a mentor and I said that. He says, well, you better do it soon, because George is 94.
What makes his motivation for the book, I think, was player safety.
Yes. And not just for pro and college athletes, but going down to the lowest levels of youth baseball, youth football. He and Harry Gill, who used to be with the Milwaukee Brewers, and a Mr. Erickson, who worked with the Twins and the Vikings, and another gentleman by the name of William Daniel, they organized the Sports Turf Managers Association, and so George's idea was the best insurance for an athlete is a safe playing field. And so that started that organization, and that's always been his philosophy.
Well, he's sure an interesting guy. Well, here he is, 94 years old. What was the writing process like with him?
It was great because, you know, you would think at that age, memory would be a challenge. But I tell you, George's memory is as sharp as ever. And I always joke with people. I said, I know George's memory is good because he keeps telling me the same stories and they never change. So he lives in Kansas City. I lived in Florida. He's a little bit hard of hearing, but you know, Larry, sports sometimes can be the great middle ground. And so we started talking about stories and issues and I rarely did I have to repeat myself because George was really honed in. And then he started telling me these various stories.
Well, there are a lot of wonderful stories in the book. How did there's so many things he did to innovate what we see on the field. Maybe you could talk about some of the things that George did to innovate on the field.
Well, one of them actually involved the Green Bay Packers. So in 1999, he and a guy by the name of Warner, they went out to prove that grass could be grown on artificial turf, because the Packers said that they would only play this exhibition game with the New Orleans Saints if it was on a grass field. So the two of them worked together, Eddie Warner and George. And they brought in all this turf, and they got it to set, and they actually used motorboats fans to dry the field, the only way to say it is cow manure. They got that on the field. They got the field set. The game was played, and Brett Favre was among the players who complimented the field. Mike Ditka said, "Let's play two," and really that basically set the groundwork, Larry, for the United States being able to have the World Cup, because they also were able to prove to FIFA officials that the World Cup could get played on all these stadiums because they had the same rules. You have to have grass fields, and so even though they had indoor facilities and artificial turf, they were able to grow grass on the turf, and that's how they were able to get the World Cup to the U.S. About 30 years ago.
That was absolutely amazing. The other one that stuck in my mind was coloring and colors on the fields, which is something he came up with, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he and it's interesting because, you know, we're talking here the 1960s, Larry, and he was a real innovator. And so he painted the end zones, and he worked with the Kansas City Chiefs, and Lamar Hunt liked it. And then all of a sudden, Pete Rozelle liked the idea. And so what happened was Pele played there on a field and said it was the second best field he played on next to Wembley Stadium. And then the commissioner came a short time after that and said, I like the way these end zones are painted and colored. And what happened was then later in November, George ended up going to Dallas because they had their first color game on television. It was a Thanksgiving game, and they wanted the field to look good. George made it look good. And basically shortly after that, the NFL came to George and says, hey, we want you to do the first Super Bowl field. And George asked if they wanted anything at midfield. And the commissioner, Pete Rozelle, said, George, it's your field. Do what you want. And so So now, yeah, now you see all these colorful end zones and you see all these colorful midfields. And that was started by George.
You know, I bet a lot of people don't know everything that goes into groundskeeping. What do groundskeepers do today?
Well, it's funny because I just had a conversation last night with a guy by the name of Mark Rasm who works with the Colorado Rockies. And he talks about how a lot of these pioneering ideas that George had and other groundskeepers like Emil Bassard had aren't practiced as much today because they're kind of spoiled into having, they have so many crew members and, you know, and then also having artificial turf makes the job a lot easier. You know, there is an art to having a level grass field, having the right dirt, having the right mix of seed. And, you know, it's a great point, Larry, because now in the old days, they used to replant the grass. Now they just replant the sod because they have enough money to do it. And George was saying is that even with these concerts that these stadiums have now, he says you don't necessarily need to replace it with sod all the time and cost all this money. You could just replace it by, if you give it a couple weeks, he had a technique where you could lay down, you know, they had it in a 50-gallon drums with seed and with Bovamere. Again, that's cow manure, and they got the seed to bloom, and they put it down on the field, and by Friday they were cutting it, by Saturday they were painting it, and Sunday they had a game. So old school stuff, Larry.
Yeah, really, really amazing the things that he came up with. Greg Handel, our guest today, he is an author and journalist, and his latest book is titled The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields, the book about George Thoma. Great to have him with us. And questions or comments or experiences, I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts on this. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. WPR brings you live special coverage on election night. You can join us tonight starting at 6. We'll share results and analysis from Wisconsin's biggest races and NPR updates from across the country. That's live coverage on election night here on WPR and WPR.org. And you can join us starting at 6 o'clock. Right now, we're visiting with Craig Handel, who has co-authored the book about George Thoma. It's titled The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. And you can join in. I hope you do. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Adam in Viroqua, we'll give you a chance to join in.
Hi, Adam. You there?
Yes, go ahead, Adam.
Just wanted to call and say love the show. Grew up knowing George. I've been in the turf industry for golf course management, Larry. Worked a lot down in Chicago and knew about George and all his stuff from the people I worked with. And just wanted to call in and say how cool it is to hear it on, you know, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh,
Larry.
Adam, thanks a lot. A comment, Craig.
Well, a couple of things. I'm wondering if Adam's talking about the Bossard family, because one of the Bossard family are very involved with the Chicago White Sox, and you talk about a family of groundskeepers. I think they go back like 125 years of groundskeeping, not on fields all over the country. And the other thing I was going to say was, you know, it's election night, and one of the things we're trying to get for George is we've got a couple of connections with the current administration. We're trying to get George the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He's been a groundskeeper for 80 years. As you mentioned, he's worked 57 Super Bowls. We talked about what he did to get the World Cup here. He also helped his profession greatly. It used to be a part-time job for people. They weren't paid well. Now they're working full-time. They're getting insurance. They're getting benefits. And so he really not just was an innovator, but he really elevated the respect of the profession. I mean, how many times do we get into situations where people are talking about the field condition, before a Super Bowl or a playoff game in baseball?
Yeah. Adam, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. I want to go back to the beginning, the beginnings with George here.
Sure.
How did he, maybe talk about his childhood first. When did he know he wanted to become a groundskeeper?
Well, it's a great point to bring up because he was a child of the Depression. And he talked about how tough his parents had it. And then they lived in Pennsylvania. And his dad died from silicosis, which is essentially coal miner's disease. So here he is, a young teenage boy, loses his father. He actually was the last one to see his father alive. You know, they did a lot of planting and gardening. He worked with a farmer who basically said, whatever you can hold in your hand or hold in your arms is what you can take back for your family, and that's what they can eat for the weekend. So it was either chickens and corn and potatoes and that. And so he grew up as one with the land, and he found out that he didn't want to work in the coal mines, and so he became a groundskeeper. And he started in his teens, and he worked on these fields, and he was fortunate that he had some really good mentors who helped him, like Emil Bassard, and he ended up going over different parts of the country, like right around shortly after World War II, they went up to Daytona and I think it was also in Georgia, and they actually used these fields that were used by the military and soldiers in preparation for going to war, and they turned these into ball fields after the war ended. And this is where he learned a lot of the techniques from Emil that allowed him to be the great groundskeeper that he was.
And I think it was Bill Vack who first hired him, I think when he was 17, something like that, as a head's groundkeeper.
Yeah, really young. And he trusted him. He brought him up. And, Vec was with the Cleveland Indians. And here's another interesting story is that just to give you an idea about just innovation is that the Indians players felt that his groundskeeping helped win them 5 to 7 games a year. And so because when Cleveland won its last World Series, they not only gave him a playoff share, I believe, but they also gave him a car. And he used that car he took the spare tire out of the car, and he used it to drive around the fields, and they used it to level the fields, the infield. And so that, it's just, George talked about how a lot of this stuff was trial and error and just using what you had. And that's what being a pioneer is all about.
I think it's an interesting story on the baseball side of things that he wound up in Kansas City. The Yankees wanted him.
Yes.
Talk about that.
He's a small town guy, Larry. And he not only did the Yankees organization, but the Yankees players, some of whom he knew, wanted him to work there. And he would have started, I believe, in Denver for a couple of years, and then he could have worked Yankee Stadium. But as a matter of fact, his mentor said, don't go to Kansas City. It'll flood you out in the spring and burn you out in the summer. It was just really hard to grow grass there because of the conditions. But George said, if I screw up, he said, no one will know. But what he did was actually the opposite. He got these fields to flourish. And because it's almost like the equivalent, Larry, of taking over a last place team and then getting them to the championship. And that's what he did with this field. And like I said, by doing so, Pele gave him a great compliment. And then the commissioner of the NFL said, well, we want you to do our first Super Bowl.
Yeah. And I think the Kansas City was the Athletics, who were kind of almost considered to be a farm system team, even though they were professionals for the Yankees.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a famous book out there that basically talked about all these deals that were made, and Charlie Finley put an end to it. I know in most baseball history, people do not think very highly of Charlie Finley, but when the draft was instituted, his first pick was Rick Monday, who later was traded for Kenny Holzman. Finley also drafted Vita Blue, Reggie Jackson, and later Sal Bando. And this became the cornerstone of the team when it went from Kansas City to Oakland. And the Athletics, as you well know, Larry, won 3 straight World Series in the 70s.
Yeah, good. Amazing story there. George had...
Oh, and then Larry, did you see the picture of Charlie Finley sitting on the mule in a New York hotel?
Yeah, we should spend a minute on Charlie Finley, because he did a lot of very innovative things with baseball. And his mule was, they called it Charlie O, I believe.
Yeah, he would take Larry the mule into a tavern, and if the tavern owner, he said, I'd like to get me and my mule a beer, and if the tavern owner agreed to it, then his team would stay at the hotel where the bar was. But if he didn't allow it, then he would just go down the street to the next hotel. So he did these kinds of things on field. He had like almost like a zoo out in the field. There's the great story George would tell about they had monkeys, and the monkeys would steal cigarettes from the people who were taking care of them. And one time the monkey escaped, and then they figured it wound up in like St. Louis or someplace. So the monkey went for a train ride. And, you know, as you mentioned, there was the mule, and then he also had a little mascot that popped up with baseballs for the umpires. So he was one of these guys. He's sort of like my cousin Steve Schmidt, who owns the Mallards. He's a great promoter of baseball.
Oh, he is indeed. And of course, in Kansas City, he got to be really good friends with a lot of people, including, you know, the stars and so forth, including George Brett was a big fan.
Yeah, they almost went into business together. Landscaping business, and it was going to be like a cut above or something like that. But George were very good friends. And as a matter of fact, George Brett wrote the first foreword on George's first book.
Yeah, amazing story. Well, he worked with Harry Gill a long time, as you mentioned earlier, a long time Brewers groundskeeper, to start the Sports Field Managers Association. And you kind of got at that, but that really was very important for the profession.
It was. I think it really just took it from a bunch of guys who were groundskeepers to an organization that we take our jobs very highly, very, very seriously. We want to do the best for the players. And, you know, one of the story, and this is where you gain trust. So one of the people who thought very highly of George was Jim Steig, who essentially ran the Super Bowl and the NFL draft for about 25 years. And if you remember Desert Storm that year, the Super Bowl was in Tampa, and And obviously they wanted to have a military theme for their halftime show. Well, the field, they had so many pregame kind of rehearsal type events during the week and it wore down on the field. And so midfield did not look good at all. So here they are. And this goes to show you how good George and his crew was. George says on a Saturday night, he says, "I've got to replace the middle of the field." And Jim Steak says, "No way, you're crazy." So George said, "I thought I was going to get arrested because we got in a bunch of cars and vans and trucks. And we went down to the University of Tampa soccer field. We rammed the gates. We went on the outskirts of the field. We grabbed all the field. We grabbed all the sod, put it back in the car, took it back to the stadium, laid it down, tamped it down, watered it about 3-4 in the morning. And they were able to make it work for the Super Bowl between the Giants and Buffalo.
An amazing story.
I mean, replacing the field less than 24 hours before the game. I mean, there's not a lot of people who would have the cojones to do that.
No. And as we were saying, Jim Steig, I think he was like something like the 43rd person hired by the NFL.
Yeah. He and George just worked in tandem. I mean, they worked overseas. They worked on the Super Bowls, and this was, you know, and really the Jim Steig has one of the great classic funny stories in the book. So Jim talks about the time that one of the Super Bowls that they had a Caribbean theme, and they had this tarp that they stretched from one end of the field to the other. The problem is that the tarp was longer than the 120 yards of the field. So George, and you got to take into the context of these times and what you were able to do. George yells into the crowd, "Does anybody got a knife?" And all of a sudden there's like a dozen or more knives flying onto the field. And George grabs one of the knives, cuts the tarp, they lay it down, and the show goes on. I mean, you can't do that now. You can't bring in a knife into a stadium. You know, it's what makes those books great, because you know, it talks about the way it used to be in it. It seemed like it was so much fun.
It did. Just rolling out those tarps. There are quite a few stories in your book about that.
Oh yeah. Because there were groundskeepers who I talked to that said, their worst nightmare was to get caught underneath those things, because it just takes a little air to get underneath them. And next thing you know, it's almost like how planes fly, you know, and then you get the tarp going up high, and then all of a sudden you get underneath it. And when it deflates, he says, you know, it's like the lights go out and you just wonder if you'll ever go back on. So it just, you know, it's an art form to be able to do the tarp work, especially in a quick manner, because like in places like Kansas City, you can be storming within minutes, and you've got to have that field, that tarp ready for the field to protect it.
Oh, man. Craig Handel, our guest today, his book, The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Well, George went to the first 57 Super Bowls. How did he see football change over the years?
It's a great question, Larry. The biggest thing, you know, he used to have this saying. He said, "Grass is grown by the inch, but killed by the feet." And what he saw and what other groundskeepers saw, and it became not just a frustration but bone of contention, was that the Super Bowl was becoming less about the game and more about the halftime show. And so what it did is it led to some serious issues. Not a lot got reported, because George really, really You know, he felt like the NFL shield was his shield, and he wanted to protect the NFL. And when there were problems with the field, a lot of times they would send George out to talk to them. And I know that George talked to them, to a lot of media, because I have boxes and boxes of clips that he gave me that we used in the book. And but he said that the field a lot of times, you know, really suffered because of the excess amount of rehearsing done for Super Bowls. And it led to Super Bowls like we saw a couple of years ago. The Super Bowl fields were just very slippery. And part of it was because of the excess rehearsals, and part of it was because there was too much watering done. And almost to the case where the sod would get moldy. And when it gets moldy, it stinks. And the footing was just awful. And yes, more than one occasion, it caused a lot of problems.
Yeah. Well, he worked with Jim Steig for a long time. And I think when Roselle left.
Steig left.
Yeah, Steig left. Talk about that change.
That's where George said the problems began, because and George said that he and Roger Goodell had a good relationship, just as he had with Pete Rozelle and Paul Tagliabue. But George, you know, George is always very outspoken, and he told Roger Goodell, he says, Roger, I got to tell you, he says, the people who you got working for you now are not as good as what they were with Tagliabue and Rozelle. And I think Goodell resented that a little bit, because when problems came up, George brought the problems up, and Goodell would kind of give him the politically correct answer of, you know, our best men are working at it, and they're pros just like you. And it led to George being very critical of some of the people Rozelle hired. And then he wrote a letter to Roger Goodell outlining all the different problems. As a matter of fact, they when they had Super Bowl 50, when they had an issue with the field where it was so slippery, an NFL member came to George's house and he said what the problems were. And when they said they were, because at this time George was a consultant, and I think that's important for people to know, that George wasn't always running the show, although that was the perception. But when he was a consultant and these problems happened, the NFL said, got an explanation from him, and it was confirmed by others that what the field problems were. And the person who was above George says, well, we're still going to keep them. And George says, well, have Goodell and have the other people talk to him. And it was never done. And to the way where the guy needed to be told that, hey, you've got to improve the way you're doing things, or we're going to have to let you go. Problem is, they never had those discussions with them. The problems continued, and that led to the last Super Bowl George worked. Remember, that was the game with the Eagles and Chiefs. Field was just too slippery, and by the time they got to the end of the week, there was really nothing the ground crew could do, and it ended up leading to the guy who worked above him, who was Ed Mangan, who ended up losing his job.
Yeah, it was a sad situation. Craig Handel, our guest today, his book, The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. Questions or comments for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk with the president of the Milwaukee Admirals hockey team about what's to come this season, and talk about the team itself. So we're looking forward to that. And right now, happy to have with us today, Craig Handel. His book is titled The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or thoughts. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. An email wonders what type of person or what type of grass is best for fields, and just what is artificial turf usually made from?
Well, that's a great question. It's interesting, Larry, and you probably know this, that the Green Bay Packers field is a combination of grass and artificial turf. And the artificial turf made from synthetic fibers, and, you know, I'm drawing a blank on the type of grass. I think it's St. Augustine, but George, I'm down here in Florida, and we were having problems with our grass, and George gave me some grass tips, and it worked. You gotta have that seed to soil contact. That's the big thing, and that means raking it in, raking that those seeds into the soil, so it catches there. And and believe it or not, that's one of the problems they ran into with the Super Bowl, is that they were only putting the seed only at the top layer. It wasn't making seed to soil contact. And you probably know this as a gardener, Larry. If you don't have that contact, what you got is you got the seed hanging up on top of the grass, and it's almost like a giant hay field.
Yeah, it's a mess. And somebody, I think it was George, said you don't cut artificial turf, but you do have to clean it. There's some great stories in there.
And because they asked him what he thought was better, grass or artificial turf. He really, other than saying that you're a lot stiffer at the end of the day on artificial turf than grass, what he said was it's about the person who takes care of it. And he said, it's just like your backyard or like your porch. You've got to brush it. You've got to wash it. You've got to clean it. And obviously they used to have problems with tobacco. They used to have problems with tobacco juice, with bubble gum, and they'd use different things to take it off the artificial turf. And they said, if just like grass, if you take care of it, that's the difference between having a good field and having a bad field.
There are some great stories in there about in your book about fixing spots on fields to make them look presentable before a game.
Oh yeah. A lot of times they would get on their hands and knees, and they would go over every inch of the field, and it just that just shows the care that's taken. And I don't know if you noticed this, Larry, but one of the I in the back of the book I wrote about my experiences of talking to George. And you know, there's this famous quote from a real popular author, and he talked about how many hours it takes to become an expert. You need 10,000 hours. Well, I did some calculating with George over time, and I talked to his wife. I did put a little research into it. Over his 80-year career, we estimate that he spent about 250,000 hours. So if 10,000 hours makes you an expert, then what does 250,000 hours do?
Well, he was the kind of guy who would, you know, 70-hour weeks were often the norm.
Oh, and he'd sleep in shovels. Or I should say in wheelbarrows. He would sleep in locker rooms. He said the best night of sleep he ever got was in a wheelbarrow.
It's an amazing story. He told some stories, too, about, I want to think back to baseball for a minute, because there are things that a groundskeeper can do on a baseball field, for example, to benefit the home team or maybe go to the detriment of the team that they were about to play? Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, it was especially on grass fields, because, you know, if you had a really good bunting team, you could slightly slant the field towards in so the bunts would stay fair. But if you were facing a good team, bat bunting team, you could slant it the other way so the bunts would roll foul if they're down the line. He would, like they knew Mickey Mantle and DiMaggio in the day, they would have, their knees weren't the best, so they made the field really hard in center field. If they knew a pitcher like Catfish Hunter, they used to play games with him with the pitching toe on the rubber. They would either make it hard or soft, depending upon which he didn't like. If they had a fast team coming into town, they would water down the first few feet by first base to slow down their run game. So this is where I was talking about before, where when Bill Veeck brought him in and he worked with Emil Bassard, that in those days they felt like you could make a 5-7 game difference during a season.
It was an amazing story. It was really a lot of fun to read all the different tricks of the trade. And here's a guy in George. He was open to mentoring and lifelong learning. You know, the guy he didn't have a college education.
But he ended up teaching at colleges.
Yeah.
You know, he taught college students. He taught agronomists. He taught people who wanted to grow into groundskeeping. He, you know, among the other things too, is he worked with young black men in Kansas City. A lot of those men ascended to higher levels of groundskeeping where they ran. They were in, like, one worked for the Kansas City Chiefs for, I believe, between 20 and 25 years. He essentially helped them get promoted by him putting in a good word for them. Dave Mailer, who worked for the Milwaukee Brewers for a number of years, he worked with George a lot. George wanted to bring him to Kansas City, but for a variety of reasons that didn't happen. And then Dave went to the Boston Red Sox, and, you know, those beautiful manicured designs of the fields that at Fenway, that where the Red Sox were known for, those were Dave Mailer's creations. And he said a lot of this came from just from cutting ideas from talking to George. George used to spend time on a lawnmower trying different cuts to see what would make the grass most aesthetically pleasing. It's just a lot of trial and error stuff. Sort of like, you know, I know, Larry, you're an avid gardener. It's the same thing when you're planting. That's the same thing George used to do. You're trying, you know, what types of soils would work here? Milorganite work here, or peat moss and perlite, would that work here? Those are the types of things, you know, George tried different clays. All this trial and error stuff, which is really kind of a lost art.
Yeah. He interacted a lot with athletes, with coaches and celebrities. What are your favorite stories about his interaction with those types of people?
Yeah. One of my favorites is that there was a former coach with the Chargers by the name of Tommy Prothrow. And in those old days of the 60s and 70s, these coaches used to be smoking. And Prothrow would go through 18 to 20 cigarettes a game. And George basically, during the game, started yelling at him, said, "You're killing my field. You're letting your cigarettes out on the field." And Prothrow ended up apologizing to George, you know. And then he also mentioned the umpires. He used to have to get onto them a little bit because they would start spitting on the field. And, you know, like I said, trying to get tobacco juice out on artificial turf was not easy to do. And, you know, he would give it to the players as well as they gave it to him. And he had a really He had a really good relationship with them, Larry. As a matter of fact, when George stopped going to the Twin Spring training, he got a call, I believe it was from Rod Carew and Tony Oliva, and they said, George, get the hell down here. We need you. You know, that's and you know, that's how popular he was. And you know, he would give it as well as he could take it.
He was recognized, I believe, many times for his work, was he not?
Eight Halls of Fame. Like we said, we're trying to get him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And that's the thing, too. He did United Way commercials. He had an ESPN commercial, which is a classic. If you want, Larry, I can email that to you sometime.
Yeah.
There was a billboard made of which had him on in Kansas City. There's a bobblehead made of him. You know, just going to the different book signings with George. When we had, Larry, when we had a book signing, it was in the perfect place. It was a place called the Grass Pad. It was for people who bought seed, sod, fertilizer. We had about 120 people show up. Maybe it was even more. And they lined up outside the warehouse. And I talked to some of these people before the event started. Larry, they came from 40, 50, 60 miles away because they wanted to meet George. They wanted to get a picture with George. And he spoke to the common man, and you know, he's a legend in Kansas City, just like Bob Uecker is in Milwaukee.
Yeah. And his name was so powerful that companies donated equipment, fertilizer, and the soil itself to Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah. They did that John Deere for about a 10-year period. George was telling me donated about $800,000 of new equipment every year. So what they would do is they would give him this new equipment. He would use it through a baseball season. They then would take after the season was over, they would resell the equipment and then give him new equipment the following year. And it's a little bitter for George because he had hoped he would have gotten paid a little better for helping save the Royals all this money, but he barely got a thank you from ownership. So that's kind of the way it goes sometimes.
And even his work at the with football, with the Super Bowls, I couldn't believe how little he was paid for the consulting work that he did.
Yeah, yeah, and he wasn't the only one. I mean, a lot of these are first-rate professional groundskeepers. And yeah, and they barely were getting $20 an hour. And it's you know, it is a sore spot when you see all the millions that the NFL makes with merchandising and commercials and player salaries and all that.
Yeah, and I think we mentioned I think they now have, there are over 3,000 employees in the NFL.
Yes. Yeah, the NFL's just become a monster. I mean, that's the great thing about the Packers is that when the Packers in July give out their annual state of the union of how much they're making, it kind of is a reflection of what these NFL teams are making. And it's just, you know, the numbers are astronomical and they just keep growing.
Well, Craig, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I enjoyed the Sod Father book, your Sod Father book, very much, the story of George Toma, and I hope we have a chance down the road to talk again. Thank you so much.
Yes, and if you get down to Florida, you're more than welcome. Give me a holler.
All right. Craig Andel co-wrote the book with George Toma, The Sod Father. Great to have him with us. His subtitle, The Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. I'm Larry Mueller.